Iranian government has been cracking down on protesters.
People are so scared to even show their face in public, worrying that they're going to get identified and arrested.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what we know about the situation in Iran on day four of an internet blackout. Also today, what people want now in Venezuela.
Que haya otras elecciones.
A free and fair election, this man says.
In Europe, overnight trains from city to city have a spotty record for passengers.
I've had amazing journeys, terrible journeys, delays, on-time arrivals.
What that means for the system.
Plus, the problem with Grok.
Someone can undress you and put it out there, and anyone can view what looks like you being naked.
That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for starting your week with us.
It is day four of an information blackout in Iran. The government has shut down communications in an attempt to stifle massive protests. Iranians have been on the streets calling for the government to be dismantled, but since late last week, getting any firsthand accounts of what's happening on the ground has been very hard. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following the story as best she can. What is the latest, Shirin?
Marco, today the Iranian state TV showed a pro-government demonstration. The president, Masoud Pezeshkian, attended it along with his supporters. And, you know, officials in Iran are trying to show defiance in the face of these protests, which honestly have been some of the largest in recent years. They also accused the protesters of being, quote, terrorists and being armed and supported by foreign actors like the U.S. and Israel.
So have the protests died down, or are people still going into the streets?
It's difficult to know the extent of the protests given the communications blackout. But from the few videos that have come out in the past 24 hours, it doesn't seem like the protests have ended. And yesterday, for example, I saw videos that showed protesters in the capital, Tehran. They usually come out at night when it's dark. And in this one video that I saw, there were hundreds of protesters on the streets and they were holding their cell phones up in the air. And you could see a sea of lights as they marched through the streets. And by the way, Marco, these protests have been taking place in many parts of the country, not just the capital, Tehran.
You know, despite the communications blackout, we have been seeing some truly grim and brutal images coming out of Iran.
Yeah, again, yesterday, state TV aired footage that showed rows of black body bags on the ground of the medical examiner's office in Tehran. You could hear families crying and hugging each other as they looked to identify their loved ones. And this has really shocked many Iranians. This is not the first time that we've seen such heavy-handed crackdown on protesters, but it seems like the extent of the brutality this time around is much more significant.
So, Shirin, you were able to speak with someone who has been in touch with protesters. Tell us about him and what he's been hearing.
Yeah, so I spoke with Dr. Kayvan Mirhadi. He's a physician based in New York, and he has this popular Instagram page that he uses to communicate simple medical advice. During the 2022 protests in Iran, he started getting messages from protesters asking him what they should do when they're injured, and he became this sort of trusted contact for protesters.
Yeah, so tell us more. What is he hearing from them?
Here's what he was hearing before things went dark.
I was getting tons of messages, mainly with larger pellet guns, significant blunt trauma like skull fractures, and a lot of messages about, you know, people seeing gunshots, you know, actual like bullets and some people dying in front of them.
Yeah, so he's getting requests for advice on pellet gunshots, actual bullets. It sounds very violent.
Yeah, and then since the communications went down, he says he's been getting fewer messages, but some are getting through. Here he is again.
These people are so scared to even show their face in public, worrying that they're going to get identified and arrested. So now imagine you have an injury. All the hospitals have Revolutionary Guard in them. If anybody shows up with blunt force trauma, gunshot wound, fracture, anything, they will try to identify them. If they have pictures of them or anything, they will arrest them.
Wow. So Revolutionary Guards are a crucial part, of course, of the government security force in Iran. So it sounds like just going to the hospital has become a liability.
Absolutely. And people who get injured have to make a decision. Do they want to risk being arrested or do they want to stay home and let their injuries take their course? Besides that, Marco, Mirhadi is hearing from doctors in Iran who say that they're also being threatened not to treat patients. And, you know, he used to be able to refer people to doctors that he trusted, but now he's not able to reach them. And that really limits how helpful he can be from afar.
You know, I had a guy that essentially had a skull fracture, and I said, this is not something you can do at home, man. Like, you have to go to the hospital and you have to make up a story. You're going to have to say I was playing sports or somebody hit me in the head or something.
He also told me that the security forces have even threatened pharmacists, saying that they can't sell antibiotics or first aid kits to protesters.
Wow, it really shows the level of oppression and paranoia. There have been several waves of protests in Iran over the past decade or so. I wonder, Shirin, how globally people are reacting to what's going on this time.
Reactions started off slow. I think at the beginning, there was a sense that this is yet another round of anti-government protests and things will pass and they will be suppressed. But in recent days, we've seen more reactions. President Trump has talked about a possible military strike, although now he says that Iranian officials have reached out to him for talks about the nuclear issue. And then today, we had the European Parliament announcing that they are banning Iranian diplomats from the European Parliament as a response to the crackdown on protesters.
The World, Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
We wanted to better understand who the Iranian opposition groups are and what they're pushing for right now. So we reached out to Nahid Siamdoust. She teaches media and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She joined us from Berlin. To begin, I asked her to describe the most visible opposition leaders inside Iran and in exile.
The main camps of opposition are really sort of coming into shape outside of Iran rather than inside of Iran. And there's a reason for that. For decades, the Islamic Republic has decimated the internal Iranian opposition. They've been imprisoned, tortured, killed. Many of them have left the country. As we speak, Narges Mohammadi, the Nobel laureate, is sitting in solitary confinement. So there's very strong opposition, not organized because, again, they've been hindered in doing so. So that's inside of Iran. Those are the brightest minds who can lead us toward a bright future. Outside of Iran, of course, people have started to come around Reza Pahlavi, the son of the former Shah of Iran, increasingly, because they see him as somebody who can bring about a transition beyond the Islamic Republic into a new system. And he has presented himself as somebody who is not there to be the next king of Iran, but who wants to facilitate that transition.
Within Iran, though, obviously these protests are happening within Iran. And so there are protesters taking on the risk of going out into the street. So while they may not be opposition parties or anything like that, are there ideologies that unite them, what they are looking for, these protesters?
Yeah, I think the main ideology that we see through the protest chants and through speaking to people in Iran is one of freedom and justice for Iranians and overcoming the Islamic Republic. Simply, you know, Iranians are fed up with this regime that is corrupt, incompetent, hypocritical, unable to really manage this country and create a future that is livable for, or even a present that is livable for Iranians, right? I mean, these protests were caused by basically an economic disaster of the rial crashing and extreme inflation. So the unifying chant and the unifying political demand of the people in Iran is to bring down the Islamic Republic.
And there is not a specific leader or party that people within Iran are calling for. They are just saying, we want the regime to end.
That's right. And I think that's precisely why we see, you know, the figure of Reza Pahlavi become more and more prominent, because there's just so few options in terms of figureheads. But, you know, the Woman Life Freedom Uprising of 2022, 2023 was called a leaderless movement. And so, you know, although it is a bit of a failure not to have a figurehead that can lead this, they have been silenced. What we do see is dozens and dozens all across Iran and all of the provinces really leading these movements, leading these protests.
Right. You have to be nimble about how you organize when leaders get taken out.
Mm-hmm.
So I did want to talk a bit more about Reza Pahlavi, the son of the deposed Shah of Iran. Can you tell me more about him, his role in these protests right now, and what his supporters want?
So his supporters have been the most vocal and the best organized in the U.S. I think that's how we need to phrase this. And speaking about him becomes immediately contentious, because there are people who will shoot you down as being a supporter of the Islamic Republic, supporter of murderers. If you say, you know, perhaps the future of Iran shouldn't be, you know, another king, because people deposed his father 40 some years ago. But he's winning more and more supporters, not necessarily as the next leader of Iran, but again, as somebody who can help them achieve their main goal, which is overcoming and overthrowing the Islamic Republic.
So Reza Pahlavi is calling people to protest. Does he want a return to the monarchy, or would he be an advocate for a democratic future for Iran?
He actually has presented himself. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, and he has actually presented himself as somebody who will facilitate a transition to the next governmental system in Iran. And he has said that he wants that to happen through elections. And so he's not putting himself forth necessarily as the next, you know, king of Iran. Of course, these things unfold in all kinds of ways that are unpredictable. But that is not what he has himself stated, right? That he wants to be the next king of Iran. But he has gone on, you know, his messages to the Iranian people to go out and protest have been broadcast on a daily basis for the last 3 or 4 days. And he's presenting himself as somebody who can facilitate that transition.
Is there a shared vision for the future of Iran among the many different streams of opposition that exist in the country and outside of the country?
I would say outside of the country, things get a little complicated precisely because the supporters of a monarchy are quite loud. But inside of the country, when you listen to the chants, when you listen to, you know, read the many years of protests and activism of the last 2 decades, yes, it's really transitioning into a secular democracy. People want to have elections and choose their next leader. But, you know, although there are some supporters for monarchy, that is not the predominant chant or, you know, request or demand or vision that we see for the future of Iran.
Is there anything specifically you will be watching for in the coming weeks?
What I'm watching for is whether within the forces of the Islamic Republic, whether it's the police, the army, the Revolutionary Guards, there's some fracture, some people basically disengaging from the state itself and perhaps coming to the support or backing of the people on the streets. And if that happens, perhaps a transition to elections and democracy from within are possible if some of those people, some leaders from within, are able to do a turnaround and actually facilitate that transition. But again, this is a highly volatile and moving situation. It's very hard to foresee where this might lead.
Nahid Siamdoust teaches Media and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. This year, she is a Humboldt Research Fellow in Berlin.
We bid a fond farewell today to a chimpanzee in Japan. The chimp named Ai has been the subject of cognitive research at Kyoto University for decades.
In 1978, she was put into an enclosure with other chimps in the university's Primate Research Institute. She was a subject in studies on perception, memory, and learning, and played a big role in the growing understanding of how chimps process the world around them.
She learned the English alphabet, Arabic numerals, and could recognize over 100 Chinese characters, including the character for the color red, as she demonstrated in a video where she taps symbols on a touchscreen. She goes for the red squares on her touchscreen and then types the Chinese character associated with the color red. You can hear the bird chirp sound effect that plays when she gets the answer right. She did pretty well on that one.
I was also a mother. Her son, Ayumu, was born in 2000, and his intellect, like his mom's, was a source of fascination. Scientists in Kyoto observed the pair to understand the transfer of knowledge from parent to child.
I, the chimp, was 49 when she died, so a half century's worth of research. That is a legacy.
You are listening to The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You've probably heard of Grok. It's the AI chatbot on the social media platform X. It has been controversial because some subscribers are using it to produce realistic and sexually explicit images with the faces of actual people. Malaysia and Indonesia have moved to ban the feature on X, but a number of countries are still trying to figure out how to respond to the misuse of Grok, including the creation of deepfakes and child pornography. Nana Nwachukwu is an AI governance expert at Trinity College Dublin. She told me today what makes Grok so susceptible to those abuses.
It's really easy. It just takes you going into the comments or thread of a post and replying Grok to say, create a naked person or remove her clothes or change her position. Just as simple as a couple of words. And then Grok will do exactly what you're looking for. It's that easy.
That sounds extremely easy. I mean, there are other chatbots out there like this where you ask it to do a thing. What is the unique concern with Grok compared to other chatbots, though?
So unlike other chatbots that have maybe a personalized platform where you send like a direct message in a secluded message feature, when Grok creates that image, it also publishes it. So it puts it out there for everyone. So that means anyone on X can view it. And in some cases, people who are not on X, who use a web feature to look at images from Grok, can do that. So someone can undress you and put it out there and anyone can view what looks like you being naked.
X has made it not possible to use this feature unless you pay a subscription to X now. What's that going to do, though?
It does nothing. Let me give you a good analogy. This feature is like you having a paid hand outside. So you're walking around the street with a paid heavyweight lifter or a bouncer or someone who you've paid to exert violence on other people. So you stop in front of a woman on the street and you say, hey, Grok, undress her. And then Grok tears off the clothes. You stop in front of another person and say, hey, Grok, put her in this position. And Grok does that. Before, they were willing to do it for you for free. Now you're paying them to do the same thing. So it means that everyone who can afford the money is going to be able to use that. And it's not like it's expensive. X subscription rates are not too expensive.
Yeah, so as you say, it's basically just making it pay to play. Nana, you've been monitoring the creation of this kind of material. How often is this happening? Sexually explicit pictures, deepfakes, that kind of thing?
It happens every day. I'm Nigerian, and you see that on my timeline, you would see different people asking and requesting for Grok to undress women who are dressed conservatively. In fact, during summer of last year, there was a Nigerian actress who typically likes to be conservative in her dressing. People prompted Grok to undress her. And this was crazy because that photograph that was generated by Grok was taken by someone else from X onto Facebook, a different platform.
That's extraordinary.
Exactly. It's not just that the images are generated in public. They can be used on a different platform by random people. So it's not just the person who requested for it.
I'm speaking with Nana Nwachukwu, an AI governance expert at Trinity College Dublin, about Grok and the controversy around Grok. The news today, of course, that Indonesia and Malaysia have moved to block this AI feature on X. Why are they some of the first?
Well, I can easily relate to why they would want to do that, because they would be looking to preserve the dignity of the women from that country, because that's a very conservative society. In my research, one of the things I've also noticed is that women from conservative societies were targeted more.
What effect will that have, though, blocking Grok in those countries?
I don't think that it will solve the problem it was designed for. Here's why I say that. Oftentimes when countries have blocked platforms for various reasons, the citizens, the people who use it, access those platforms using VPN. There's nothing that stops that from happening. So it does not give accountability, does not trigger accountability in any form.
So Elon Musk, the head of X and Grok, says users are making these pictures and victimizing the subjects in them. Therefore, users are the ones who are liable. And yet X is the owner of this Grok tool. Where does responsibility land here?
Well, it is a jointly owned responsibility. First of all, the platform has the primary responsibility because it can kick away the user from the platform. It can install safeguards in Grok. So the platform has primary responsibility. Secondary responsibility, which is a function for the police of wherever the user is resident, but the police cannot hold the user accountable without the support of X. X has to provide evidence. X has to provide support to law enforcement for that to happen. So all in all, responsibility goes back. The buck, like you say, ends up on the table of X.
If someone uses Grok in the U.S., though, for an example, to create a sexual image of a person in Sweden, what can the Swedish government do in that case if there are different laws to protect people's face or likenesses?
Now, that's where the gap is. So this is the big problem. This is the second big problem about big tech, right? We live in a different dispensation, a new world order, where these laws cannot protect us. We can only protect what is local. You cannot protect what is global anymore. A good example is that this happened to the Swedish deputy prime minister herself. She was a target of this current trend. She was undressed on X by someone who's, according to their X profile, is in the United States of America. Now, there's nothing she can do except maybe sue the person in the United States of America for maybe damages. But the question is, can she? Can she really afford to go trans-border to sue someone, to go through the whole legal process? There's a gap. Technology has created a new world order, and we have to start to figure out or to reason how to truly regulate this particular type of technology.
Where do you see all of this headed?
Well, there is a global shift. There will be people who would elevate AI safety, and then there will be people who would push for futurism, AI optimism, people who want global dominance like America. There'll be people who would be pushing for more use of AI, more innovation. And then there's also people who will be pushing for AI safety. So the whole point is for us to understand that while some countries would tighten their laws, other countries are going to make their laws a little bit loose. I mean, at the end of it all, capitalism wins.
And what about the victims? Because there are a lot of them right now.
To be honest, I think that the first step in the right direction is to see what the local laws can do. We have to test the laws we already have. I think it will be important to see maybe where people start to sue X. Let's see where it goes from there. Even in America, let's test it in the home country of X. So if we don't test the local laws, we don't know where the gaps are really.
Nana Nwachukwu is an AI governance expert at Trinity College Dublin. She spoke to me today from Dublin. Stay tuned here for updates from Venezuela. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Venezuela's political landscape has transformed completely in the last week since the ouster of the country's longtime leader, Nicolas Maduro. And there are a lot of questions about what comes next for the country. The World's Tibi Saizea is in Caracas to tell us what she is seeing and hearing at this pivotal moment. Tibi, what does the city feel like right now?
You know, Carolyn, what is so surreal here in Caracas is that you have this huge event that shaped the entire country, and no one is talking about it publicly. You go about the city and you see busy streets, traffic, people shopping, and, you know, then you have these radio stations playing music. There is no political analysis, and I think people here are used to you know, putting politics on the background and focus on daily life, daily problems. And I think most of the conversation happens on social media and WhatsApp. And then you see people having to delete all these sensitive chats before they go out of their homes because there are reports of armed militias randomly checking phones and searching for any signs of sympathy toward the U.S. military attack on Venezuela. So you see, you know, some people don't even want to share any information on WhatsApp or social media in case they forget to delete those before they go out. Yeah.
And people aren't talking about all of this, of course, because it's dangerous to do so, right? It would be dangerous to talk about the deposing of Maduro.
Yes, exactly.
The U.S. issued another warning this weekend urging its citizens to leave Venezuela immediately. The warning cited those armed militias you mentioned, the one checking people's phones, plus the risk of terrorism and kidnapping. Are Venezuelans there scared?
You know, I haven't personally run into these checkpoints that are operated by these pro-government militias. And I've been talking to taxi drivers, and they tell me, you know, they mostly see them in certain areas of the city. And it was more common right after Maduro was removed, but not so much right now. And in terms of the risk of arbitrary detentions and kidnapping by the regime, you know, this can happen. But I think right now there is something different. There is a lot of U.S. pressure on this regime. The new leader, Delcy Rodriguez, is in power, and people tell me they don't think she will be doing a hard crackdown on dissent right now because, again, she's facing a lot of pressure from the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the government actually said, the Venezuelan government, that they will be releasing a number of political prisoners. They have already started doing that in the past few days. Of course, you know, this is not to say that we are transitioning into a safe country.
That's so interesting, TB. I know you said you were speaking to taxi drivers. What were they saying to you?
I think the general feeling is most people are very happy to see Maduro gone because he was a very unpopular leader. But not everyone is happy about how things are unfolding now for Venezuela. And I don't see anyone in celebratory mode right now here in Caracas. Well, first, because, of course, you can go to jail if you do that in public. But even in private, you know, I don't think people are very optimistic, unfortunately, about the future. And I don't think they see a clear path to real change here. Some people do because they say this is a window of opportunity, a different scenario. But, you know, I talked to this taxi driver who spoke to me this morning. He lives in a poor neighborhood. Here's what he told me.
Para mí que haya otras elecciones, de verdad que sí. Que haya otras elecciones y ya cada quien decida por quién va a votar y que siempre y cuando los votos sean correctos.
Yeah, he says he wants free and fair elections and being able to elect their next leader, of course, but he doesn't see that happening anytime soon. So for him, what is really urgent is the economy.
Almen, mira, te soy sincero, $60, por decirlo así, poniéndole el dólar.
He says he makes about $60 a month. He gets some money from family abroad. But the economic situation in Venezuela is really dire. And I see people kind of optimistic on that sense that this, you know, quote unquote, negotiations with the U.S. will or can bring some economic stability to the country. Mm.
And that is more of a priority for people, you're saying, than transition to democracy or actually being able to vote. There's a more pressing need to them.
Exactly. That's what I'm hearing here.
There are reports that a couple hundred foreign journalists are stuck in Colombia trying to get into Venezuela. Is the Venezuelan government keeping them out intentionally? Do we know?
Yeah, absolutely. They have deployed intelligence agents across the border with Colombia, and these agents are checking phones, luggage, and some some of these journalists report that they were interrogated for long hours. Last week, there were 14 journalists, mostly foreign correspondents, who were detained inside Venezuela in Caracas. They were later released. But, you know, authorities are confiscating equipment of journalists who are in the country, or, you know, asking reporters to delete whatever they recorded. Mm.
The World Series, Isaiah, in Caracas. Thank you so much for the update. Stay safe.
Thank you, Caroline.
Sleeper train service has been added to select routes in Europe in recent years. Routes from Paris to Berlin and Vienna to Amsterdam have been popular, but the revival of overnight train service has had challenges too. Chief among them, a lack of support from European governments, as we hear from the World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry.
Dutchman Chris Engelsman celebrated the reopening of the night train service between Berlin and Brussels with a ceremony over 2 years ago.
This is the very first departure of the train, and that's why we're here celebrating this nice event.
Engelsman is the co-founder of a startup called European Sleeper that operates night trains across the EU. Interest in sleeper trains has soared in recent years, driven partly by climate concerns and a bit of nostalgia for how travel used to be before budget airlines took over. One popular route has been the Paris to Berlin service.
It leaves in the evening, runs overnight, and the next morning you're in Berlin. It takes about 13 hours.
Kevin Chirsa, a reporter with DW, hopped on the train in Paris late one evening last month. The next morning, he was in the centre of Berlin, no airport security to have to deal with. But there was a catch.
I arrived here not with the sleeper train I boarded in Paris, but with the ICE fast train that went from Strasbourg, because my sleeper train, the Nightjet, was cancelled mid-journey.
And the trip that was supposed to be 13 hours took 19 instead. In late December, the service was scrapped. The operator said it was because the French government had withdrawn funding for the route. Delays can be a problem with sleeper trains, as different countries work on their tracks overnight.
There was a time when engineers knew how to maintain the track around the trains, and sleeper trains ran all the time and they got through.
Mark Smith runs train travel website Seat61. He used to work for a British rail operator for many years.
These days, the engineers think they can close the railway at night, dig up all the track. And, for example, one of the things that has killed the Paris to Vienna sleeper train is not lack of demand. It's that every few nights, the civil engineers would decide to dig up the track and the train got cancelled.
When the Paris to Vienna and Paris to Berlin routes were cancelled last month, night train enthusiasts dressed in pyjamas camped out at stations across several European countries in protest.
We're here tonight at the Helsinki Central Railway Station in solidarity with cities all across Europe.
Right now, we're at the central station in Stockholm.
And this is why we're here at this pyjama party, to keep our night trains alive.
But Chris Engelsman with European Sleeper had some good news for travellers.
Paris-Berlin service, we've taken it over. Yeah, it's in the heart of our area. It's a critical route with a lot of demand expected.
Engelsman tells me his company expects to have the Paris-Berlin route back up and running by March. Demand for night trains isn't an issue in Europe.
The fundamental problem remains unsolved. There simply are not enough night train carriages to go round.
Rail expert John Wirth, who lives in Burgundy in France, says no one has built new night carriages in over three decades.
The big railway companies could run night trains or could enter this market if they wanted to. So think Deutsche Bahn or SNCF. But they don't really want to because they see shorter, faster daytime trains as more profitable.
Sleeper trains usually only run once per night. They need extra staff on board, and because there are beds, not just seats, capacity is lower than day trains. John Wirth reckons he's been on most night trains across Europe.
I've had amazing journeys, terrible journeys, delays, on-time arrivals. The best night trains in Europe, it's kind of a bit of a secret because not so many people ever travel there, are in Finland.
But he says, don't expect too much luxury. Private operators like Chris Engelsman's European Sleeper often have to resort to using old rolling stock.
But it's cobbled together with a bunch of old carriages, which are basically saved from the scrap heap.
Engelsman sees it a little differently.
It's the traditional vintage night train, and it has its advantages too, because you can open the window, for instance. It has its charm, and most people are very happy with the comfort.
What Engelsman and Wirth both agree on is that the bureaucracy involved in running night trains across the EU is not for the faint-hearted. Governments in countries like France and Germany have shown little interest in investing in the service. Deutsche Bahn, the German rail operator, told me in a statement that night trains are economically very challenging. Part of the problem, the company said, was that trains are not operating on a level playing field with airlines, for example, when it comes to energy costs or tax. Mark Smith says Deutsche Bahn has a point.
Airlines have a massive hidden subsidy. They pay no tax on their aviation fuel, which is effectively getting their fuel half price. And of course, there are some countries that impose VAT on train tickets, including international train tickets. Germany does, Austria does. You know, it's almost as if the governments say one thing, but in everything they actually do, want to promote air travel.
Despite all the hurdles, Chris Engelsman of European Sleeper says he's confident night trains will expand across the bloc. There's still something romantic, he says, about travelling by train across Europe through the night.
We are running a business now, so we're not being romantic about it all day. But I do think that's one of the reasons that night train travel is so popular, that it's a little bit more than being transported from A to B.
And he says you can roll down the window and watch the world go by. Now that's something no budget airline can offer. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is busy these days. He is heading to China tomorrow. That's on the heels of a trip to Europe to pledge support for the Danish government in the face of U.S. threats to take over Greenland. Carney is framing his China visit as an opportunity to improve what have been fraying ties lately between Ottawa and Beijing. The World's Matthew Bell has our story.
Canada's relationship with China took a nosedive in 2018. That's when Beijing detained two Canadian citizens on charges that were widely seen as bogus. More recently, trade has become a contentious issue. Canada slapped tariffs on Chinese-made electric vehicles in 2024. China responded with tariffs on Canadian canola products. This week's visit by Mark Carney to Beijing is seen as a historic opportunity. It's the first by a Canadian prime minister to China in nearly a decade. It also comes at a moment when Ottawa is facing unprecedented pressure from its closest ally and trading partner. Lynette Ong is a political science professor at the University of Toronto.
This is very salient in the aftermath of re-election of President Trump and his trade war against Canada, and then the talk of 51st state of Canada becoming the 51st state, essentially threatening the sovereignty of Canada, throwing the very strong security, political, and economic partnership that the country has enjoyed for decades, that has been thrown out of the window.
A deal on canola exports is priority number one for Carney on this trip. China is the biggest buyer of canola in the world, and canola farmers in places like Saskatchewan are feeling the pain. Overall, the Canadian government has set a goal of doubling all non-U.S. exports over the next decade. Cody Blois is the Prime Minister's parliamentary secretary. He told the CBC that Carney sees tremendous opportunities for this trip.
He believes there's opportunity for partnership, that there's opportunity that China plays a role amongst the many countries that we are building relationships with as part of our idea to be able to build out more trade around the world.
But Charles Burton worries about potential compromises, especially on human rights issues, that Prime Minister Carney will be asked to make by Beijing. Burton is a former Canadian diplomat and the author of The Beaver and the Dragon, How China Outmaneuvered Canada's Diplomacy, Security, and Sovereignty.
I'm not sure that we can get an assurance from the Chinese Communist Party that they won't continue to threaten Canadian national security or use economic coercion to further their larger geostrategic and political agendas in Canada.
Burton says there are huge concerns in Canada about the Chinese government conducting foreign influence operations, harassing Canadian citizens of Chinese origin, and threatening Taiwan. Yes, there's a lot of frustration with President Trump's treatment of Canada, especially with the tariffs, but making concessions to China, Burton says, hasn't worked to boost trade in the past, and he's skeptical about it working now.
The current mission by Mr. Carney does have a certain resemblance to a tribute mission by a subordinate state in that he's bringing five cabinet ministers with him without very much expectation of anything happening beyond showing the Chinese regime great respect. I think that that's what this is really all about. And Canada's declaration that we have a strategic partnership with China now, I imagine, is going over like a lead balloon in the White House.
There's a lot at stake for Canada, and the risks are many, including the possibility of stoking further hostility from the Trump White House. But Roland Paris at the University of Ottawa says Mark Carney is aware of the potential downsides.
Canada has long had a substantial trade relationship with China, just like the United States does. But the problem has been over the last many years that there's been very little high contact engagement between the two countries because of disputes. Part of the purpose of this trip is to restore a measure of stability in the Canada-China relationship so that the disputes don't end up escalating. And secondly, to try and look for areas in which it may be possible to expand Canada-China trade.
Paris says Prime Minister Carney has talked about the importance of setting guardrails to protect Canada's national security interests. He also seems to have broad public support for at least pursuing better relations with China at a time when the Trump administration has upended the relationship with its northern neighbor. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There's renewed focus on Greenland right now because President Trump has said the U.S. needs it for national security. Greenland has a strategic location in the Arctic, but it also has huge reserves of critical minerals needed for electronics, including military equipment. Patrick Schroeder explained why that's a big deal. He's a senior research fellow at Chatham House in the U.K.
That's currently a supply chain that's, as we know, dominated by China. So China produces most of the rare earth minerals and processes most of the rare earth minerals internationally. And these are needed for clean energy technologies, for magnets that are used in electric vehicles or wind turbines. They're also used in defense applications. So that's why these rare earth elements are also considered now to be part of broader resource security strategies.
Resource security as national security. So just how big are the deposits of these rare earth minerals in Greenland?
Yeah, the deposits that are there are quite significant, especially in the south of Greenland, but they currently haven't been actively mined. At the moment, there's some gold mining happening in Greenland. There has been some uranium mining, but that uranium mine has been closed because of pollution issues around radioactive waste that occurred in 2021. The Greenland government shut down that uranium exploration. And the rare earth elements, that's in the same area as the uranium mining site.
And so why are those not being mined yet?
So what's challenging has been infrastructure or lack of infrastructure. Greenland doesn't have any roads, so everything will need to be brought in by ship from outside of Greenland. That's one of the major costs for everything, the logistics, not only for mining, but other economic activities in Greenland as well. There's also issues around energy supply for mining operations. Then we're thinking about the workforce that's going to be brought in. Let's say if we're talking about several hundred of additional workers and their families moving to Greenland, the communities in these areas are very small, only sometimes a few hundred people. So it would require building accommodation, but also then hospitals, schools. So it requires quite a significant investment in planning. So the costs of developing a mine in Greenland is quite significant, probably in the order of, I don't know, hundreds of millions is what I've read. And that also cannot be done quickly. So this requires some long-term strategic thinking and planning.
And how long would that take if a company started going all in right now to try to get critical minerals from Greenland? How long would it be before it were a significant source of these materials?
That's something between 5 to 10 years to have significant supply, not only through the mining, but in also establishing the downstream processing and refining, because these facilities also still need to be developed.
Now, we call these rare earth minerals, but they're not actually rare. It's just that they are can be hard to extract and process. Why would somebody look to Greenland to get these metals when they exist in lots of other places where the infrastructure already does exist? What are the advantages of trying to go there?
Yes, you're right. They're not actually rare. There's many places where there are rare earth minerals, including also the U.S. Mountain Pass mine in California, where the U.S. can mine domestically. Australia is also mining rare earth minerals in Western Australia. In the north of Sweden, there are also deposits which are now being explored. There's also issues in Sweden around the rare earth mineral deposits being on indigenous community land. But one reason why there hasn't been mining in many places outside of China over the last couple of decades, because rare earth mining also entails significant environmental damage, both in the mining and then also in the processing and refining. So it requires a wide range of different chemicals to separate the rare earth elements from rock or from soil, and that's quite polluting. So that's the big challenge that will take, as I said before, so many years to build up again.
Does that seem realistic to you, turning Greenland into a major source of these minerals?
I think it can be realistic if it's if we have a long-term perspective. Actually, a lot of Greenlanders I spoke to, I had the chance to visit last year in November, a lot of Greenlanders would like to see mining happening as a way of diversifying the economy and bringing in additional revenues to the country. But it really needs to be done in a process that actively involves communities. This slightly relates to the push for independence in Greenland, because currently Greenland depends a lot on Danish government funding. About half of the annual budget for Greenland is paid by the Danish government. So many Greenlanders look at expanding mining as an additional source of revenue that could then also help Greenland to become economically independent from Denmark in the long term.
Patrick Schroeder is a senior research fellow at the Environment and Society Center at Chatham House in the UK. Finally today, now that I'm over the hardest part, a little breakup music that caught our ears a couple summers ago. Speed of Light is the song. The artist simply goes by the name of Dhruv. Despite his focus on lost love, his sound is pretty upbeat.
Damn, you're wasting no time, he sings. Found yourself somebody new at the speed of light. Other tracks on his debut album, Private Blizzard, include Grieving and Tragedy. Clearly, Dhruv has something on his mind. Now I wish I could press fast forward. Dhruv's got roots in India. He was born in London, raised in Singapore, moved to the States a few years ago to study at Yale, but then hit pause on college to get serious about music.
He'd been smitten with Bollywood by the age of 5 and would go on to write songs in private. One of them, Double Take, became a sleeper hit on TikTok in 2021. It went to number 1 in the Philippines and Thailand and hit the top 5 on the streaming charts in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore.
Speed of Light is one of the singles on Private Blizzard.
The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.